Last week we began in the book of 1 Samuel, and I invite you to turn there now. And here's the story so far in 1 Samuel. We met this man, Elkanah. And Elkanah has the misfortune of having two wives. One of his wives is naturally the favorite. This is Hannah. He has another wife, Peninnah, who is not the favorite, but she has the kids. Right? So Peninnah bullies Hannah, the favorite. She's obviously resentful. Hannah doesn't have kids. This is a bad thing in ancient Israel, not to have kids, especially not to have sons. So she cries out to God. And when they go to the tabernacle at Shiloh, as they do regularly, as good Israelites do, she goes and she prays at the temple. And she asks God to give her a son. And she says, "If you give me a son, God, then I'll dedicate him to you. I'll give him back to you. So far, so good." We remember this story every time we have a baby dedicated, right? And often I cite it. I say, you know, what you're doing is sort of what Hannah did. You know, you're taking your baby and you're saying, you know, this baby really belongs to you, God. You know, and we like that, right? It's nice symbolism. And we like the symbolism, and that's where we leave it. Hannah, as it turns out, actually does what none of you have ever done in a dedication, right? She takes the baby, and well, she weans it, and then she takes the baby to the tabernacle and leaves it there, right? Leaves this little toddler, Samuel. So at the end of 1 Samuel chapter 1, we have poor little toddler Samuel left at the tabernacle under the care of Eli, right? None of you have ever done that, right? None of you have ever said, "Well, Dan, yeah, I'll be back in a couple of years when this baby is weaned and you can have him or her," right? None of you have done that. I wonder why, right? Well, what's life like for little, you know, poor little toddling Samuel left behind at the tabernacle under the care of Eli? We pick up the story in 1 Samuel chapter 2, beginning in verse 12. 1 Samuel chapter 2, beginning in verse 12. Eli's sons were wicked men. They had no regard for the Lord. Now it was the practice of the priests with the people that whenever anyone offered a sacrifice, and while the meat was being boiled, the servant of the priest would come with a three-pronged fork in his hand, He would plunge it into the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot, and the priest would take for himself whatever the fork brought up. This is how they treated all the Israelites who came to Shiloh. But even before the fat was burned, the servant of the priest would come and say to the man who was sacrificing, "Give the priest some meat to roast. He won't accept boiled meat from you, only raw." But if the man said to him, "Let the fat be burned up first and then take whatever you want," the servant would then answer, "No, hand it over now. If you don't, I'll take it by force." This sin of the young man was very great in the Lord's sight, for they were treating the Lord's offering with contempt. Well, this is bad stuff, right? And if you want to know how bad it is, well, you would want to read back to the book of Leviticus. You could use Leviticus chapter 7, for example, as background to this. And you can go and study it if you want. And it would tell you that there are very precise rules for exactly what the priests get and how they get it from the sacrifice. The priests get part of the sacrifice. They have to eat. You know, priests have to eat. But there are rules for it. And the rules have no resemblance to what's going on in the tabernacle in Shiloh under Eli and his sons, right? No resemblance at all. So they're basically stealing the offerings. You know, it's the equivalent of me, you know, well, there's stuff here, right? I mean, it's all for me, right? Anything I want. It's the equivalent of me just, you know, taking money out of the offering bank, offering any Sunday, however much I want, only kind of worse, right? And the story actually gets worse from there. If we go down to verse 22, "Now Eli, who was very old, heard about everything his sons were doing to all Israel and how they slept with the woman who served in the entrance to the tent of meeting. So he said to them, 'Why do you do such things? I hear from all the people about these wicked deeds of yours. No, my sons, it is not a good report that I hear spreading among the Lord's people. If a man sins against another man, God may mediate for him. But if a man sins against the Lord, who will intercede for him?' His sons, however, did not listen to their father's rebuke, for it was the Lord's will to put them to death." So not only are they abusing the sacrifice, right? Not following the rules, stealing from the people, bullying the people, you know, sending out their goons to people bringing sacrifice and forcing meat out of them. They're also sleeping with the women at the entrance to the temple, making it into a place of prostitution. And Eli is this completely ineffective father who sees this and says, no, 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 you should not be doing this, boys, and does nothing, right? And so we get this terrible story of these two priests. And this is the environment in which Samuel is growing up. And the immediate impact on this, and I'm sure this is supposed to be the impact is, this is terrible. I mean, these are priests, right? These are priests that are doing this. How could priests do this kind of thing? We know what priests are supposed to be like. Right, we see good priests in movies every once in a while, and so we know what good priests are supposed to be like. Or we read the beginning of Les Miserables, and we know what the good bishop, the good priest, is supposed to act like. Right, they're good people. Or we see Of Gods and Men. You know, wonderful movie, and these brothers in North Africa. Well, they're the ideal priests. Right, they're worshiping all the time. They're serving people. They're always giving, always sacrificing, always selfless. They're not like Hophni and Phineas. So how do priests go bad, right? I mean, how is it that Hophni and Phineas, these two priests, go bad? You know, is it just that they had really bad names and, you know, so they're reacting to their bad names or something? I mean, they are strange names, you know? What is it? Was it Eli was a really bad dad somehow? Well, you know, he wasn't exactly the best dad in the world. What was it that made Hophni and Phineas go bad? So I was thinking about this. And I thought, you know, really, in order to answer this question, we need a wider perspective on priesthood. So I was imagining, how could we get a wider perspective? And I thought, what if we were to put together an anthology of priest stories? You know, priest stories through the ages, right? And so we'd have this book, and I could see it right now in my mind's eye on the shelves of Barnes & Noble. In fact, just as you walk in, it would be sort of priest stories through the ages, and it would be a big seller, right? And where would it begin? Well, you know, why don't you begin with the paradigmatic priest in Scripture? Who's the first priest in Scripture? Well, it would be Aaron, right? Aaron, Moses' brother Aaron, is this great priest, the beginning of the priesthood. And he must be a good priest, right? Because God chose him. God said, you be the priest, Aaron, and you know, you're going to help out Moses, and you're going to do all the priestly stuff. So what's Aaron like? Exodus chapter 32. Remember that chapter? Well, maybe you don't, but Exodus chapter 32. Moses has gone up on Mount Sinai to talk to God, to get the Ten Commandments. The people are waiting down below. Aaron's with them. He's put in charge by his brother, right? Moses has gone a long time. The people say, where's Moses? You know, show us, give us a God, Aaron. We want a God. We want a God we can see. Aaron says, okay, give me your jewelry. He melts the jewelry down. He makes this wonderful golden calf. Aaron does this, the priest of God, right? The first great priest. This is what Aaron does, right? So this would be the first story in our anthology of great priest stories, right? And then you think, okay, well, it's got to get better after that. And so you turn to Leviticus chapter 10. And in Leviticus chapter 10, you get the story of Aaron's sons. The priests, Aaron and his sons, have just been ordained as the first priests in Israel. And what is the first thing that happens in Leviticus chapter 10? Well, it says, Nadab and Abihu, these two sons of Aaron, give unauthorized fire. Whatever that means, I have no idea, but the result is they have to be struck dead. You know, so the first successors to Aaron, right after they've been appointed to the job, are struck dead because they're not good priests. They're not following the rules. So our anthology is getting really interesting. And so we would move forward, and there are other things I would definitely include in my anthology. I would probably include, for example, Ezekiel chapter 34, which is this whole chapter talking about how priests in Israel are like shepherds who eat their sheep, right? Who are shepherds who are acting like wolves. Right? So I'd include that. I would definitely include the entire book of Malachi, because the entire book of Malachi is a diatribe against priests and talking about all of the ways that they're doing things wrong. And then I would move forward to Jesus, and there would be a number of things that I would use, but I would definitely include the parable of the Good Samaritan. Why? Because who are the bad guys in the parable of the Good Samaritan? We know who the good guy is. He's the Samaritan. But who's the bad guys? The priest and the Levite, who walk by this guy injured on the road and say, no, I can't touch him. I can't do anything. So from Jesus' point of view, who's the bad guys? The priests, the Levites. This anthology is looking really, really interesting. And why stick to just biblical literature, right? We can move beyond biblical literature. In fact, we can make it international. If you want some of the best stories in Iranian literature, there'll be stories of this guy named Mullah Nasruddin. Mullah Nasruddin is a religious leader, a member of the clergy, who is the most mocked, the most sort of funny character in all of Persian literature. He is always making a fool of himself, and it demonstrates for you how much most Iranians think of the clergy. Right? There's this anti-clergy sort of literature out there in almost every culture that you find. You can trace it into, you know, all through English literature as well. You know, you want good examples? Well, read Les Miserables and see some of the things that Victor Hugo will tell us about the clergy in France during his time. You know, there's this great mockery and criticism of the clergy. Read Jane Austen, right? The clergy in Jane Austen are laughable characters, right? Why do people become clergymen? Because they want an easy living. They don't have enough money for themselves, and they don't have any skills to be able to do anything useful, so they have to find a clergy post in order to be able to just, you know, go on doing nothing. That's what they do. And then they're always trying to, you know, find the nice women anyway, right? Even though they don't have any money. So we have throughout English, we'd have this really wonderful anthology, and you know what the effect would be? The effect would be to say, well, Hophni and Phineas fit right in. Right? Hophni and Phineas are not this great exception. Hophni and Phineas are almost the rule. Okay, yeah, we can find exceptions to the rule. You know, we can talk about how Ezra was kind of a nice priest in the Bible, but these exceptions to the rule are actually pretty rare. You know, mostly, when we actually think about the history of priests, we have this really kind of negative history, and so that raises a really interesting question for me. Why not get rid of them? I mean, if they're so bad, and if all of our cultures through all of time have really kind of hated priests underneath, then, well, why don't I just, first of all, sit down, because you'll probably hate me too, right? I mean, pastors are sort of like priests, right? We do all this ritual kind of stuff. You know, why don't we just get rid of the whole business? Why do we need priests at all? Well, it turns out that there is a whole book of the Bible kind of devoted to that question. And it's a book that nobody likes to read, right? Because it's devoted to that question. It's the book of Leviticus, right? So you begin reading the book of Leviticus, and you don't have to do that now, although if you're kind of bored with the sermon, you can, right? So you begin reading the book of Leviticus, and what do you find? Well, you'll begin reading, and you'll read about offerings, right? And you'll read about burnt offerings, and you'll read about sin offerings, and you'll read about fellowship offerings, and you'll read about wave offerings, which are really kind of interesting. You know, the priest takes this offering and waves it. That's exactly what it is. It's a wave offering, right? So you read about all of these offerings, and with each of these offerings, you read all of these rules about exactly how the offering is supposed to be given, right? And you read about the tabernacle, and, you know, what's supposed to happen there, and what the priests are supposed to do. And all of these rules about how you're supposed to bring your sacrifices to God and what you're supposed to do. And so, you know, the book of Leviticus ends up basically telling us all of these detailed rules about how you're supposed to worship God. And you know what? You don't have any chance of being able to do any of them or keep any of those rules unless you have a priest, because the priests are the specialists, right? They're the ones that have to be there to do this. So it turns out that priests are a lot like attorneys. A lot like attorneys, right? Because think about it. Okay, so there are some good attorneys out there. I will acknowledge that. But people do not generally like attorneys. Why? Because, well, you know, when you're afraid, first of all, that they're going to charge too much, and many of them do. You're afraid they might be unscrupulous, and many of them are, right? And so, you know, you tend not to like attorneys very much, lots of people, and so there are all of these attorney jokes out there. But if you have to go to court, if there's a suit against you, or if you're a defendant in a case, you need an attorney, right? I mean, you can try to represent yourself, and some people do, but you know what? You go into that court, and there are all sorts of rules that you are completely unaware of, that you just don't know how to navigate that system. You have to have the attorney with you to help you to navigate that system, because they're the professional. They're the one who knows how to do it, right? And so it's actually very much like priests. We don't like attorneys because we're dependent on them, and we, you know, are afraid that they're going to take advantage of us. And throughout history, people have not liked priests because they're dependent on them, and they're afraid they're going to take advantage of them, and they do a lot. Right? So there's this interesting parallel between priests and between attorneys, right? And so we can't live without them, right? And if you were living in ancient Israel, then there's no do-it-yourself manual for sacrifice. There is no Home Depot for building your own tabernacle at home. Right? You have to have the priests. You have no choice about it. They may be unscrupulous, they may be evil, but you're like those people meeting Hophni and Phinehas, going up to them and saying, you know, please, you know, do the sacrifice right, you know, because you don't have any choice. They're the priests, you know, you're the people. You have to do it. You have no choice. Because there are these rules, and you don't know what the rules are, you can't do them yourself, so you have to rely on those priests. And that then just pushes the question to another level. And that is, okay, we need priests because there are all these rules. Why do we need the rules? I mean, what's the point of all these rules? Why don't we just get rid of the rules, then we can get rid of the priests? Well, imagine visiting England. Okay, Carol and I are actually going to visit England on our way back from Chad in a few weeks. We're going to visit England. And let's say that we decide we want to visit our friend Liz in England. You know, Liz, the one who has the really big house. Actually, more than one big house. Really, really big house. She has plenty of room for us. So we're going to visit Liz the second, actually. And so we're, you know, so we'll write ahead and we'll say, Liz, we're coming, right? You know, let's say this works out, that we actually get an audience with Queen Elizabeth. Let's say that we get an audience with Queen Elizabeth. What are we going to have to go through to actually get that audience? We're going to have to go through probably several protocol officers, first of all, who will examine our clothing to make sure our clothing actually is perfect for whatever the occasion is, will tell us exactly what we are to do, how we are to walk, where we are to stand, what we are allowed to say and what we are not allowed to say, right? And then, you know, will tell us how we are to leave, right? And everything will be set out. And if we do not follow protocol, then, well, we will be very quickly, I think, whisked away. Why? Because Queen Elizabeth is the queen, and we are the descendants of rebellious colonists, right? And she will not let us forget this. There is a distance between us, and that distance will be protected by rules and by protocol. Why is it that the temple, the tabernacle, and then the temple in Israel has all of these rules and barriers? It is because God is God, and you are a rebellious creature, and you have no right to come into the presence of God, and all of those rules are meant simply to remind you of that. All of the rules, all of the barriers are meant to remind you, you are a sinner, God is a holy God, you have no right to come into the presence of God, and you know what happens if you come into the presence of God? You deserve to die. And so the sacrifice that is given reminds you of that. Every time you bring a sacrifice to the temple, a life is given, right? An animal dies because of you, because you're a sinner, because God is holy. You put your hand on that animal in order to identify with the animal and say, this animal should have been me, right? I should have died. That's the whole point of the whole sacrificial ritual, is to remind you who you are and who God is and what a vast distance there is between them. And the priest is the enforcer of the system. The priest is there to say, this is the system, I'm a part of that system, and I'll help it to run. That's what the priest does, right? It's just part of this system to remind you, the worshiper, that you have this great distance, that you don't deserve to be in the presence of God, that you actually deserve to die because of your sin and because of your rebellion. Now that's really interesting, right? I mean that, and so then we can ask, okay, so the priest has this position as enforcer of the system. What about bad priests? You know, well, what, you know, why? What do you do then with bad priests? I mean, priests as enforcers of the system, well, you expect them to be good, right? So what function do bad priests play? And then we can go back to 1 Samuel chapter 2. We can ask, okay, what function do Hophni and Phinehas play in this story? 1 Samuel chapter 2. And something interesting happens in this chapter as we read through. If we had read through straight, rather than sort of picking and choosing, we would have noticed something. And we can begin with verses 11 and 12, actually begin with verse 12. Eli's sons were wicked men, but verse 11 had said, but the boy, that is Samuel, ministered before the Lord under Eli the priest. And then we could go down to verse 17. This sin of the young men, that is Hophni and Phinehas, was very great in the Lord's sight, verse 18, but Samuel was ministering before the Lord. Or we could go down to verses 25 and 26, the second part of verse 25. His sons, however, did not listen to their father's rebuke, verse 26, and the boy Samuel continued to grow in stature and in favor with the Lord and men. And then chapter 3, verse 1, the boy Samuel ministered before the Lord under Eli. And the whole point of Hophni and Phinehas is to point us to Samuel, is to say, these guys are really bad, and you're meant to notice that Samuel is offering another model, another hope, a different kind of priest, someone who will truly minister before the Lord. And so should we put our hope in Samuel? You know, Samuel, that does actually turn out to be this pretty good priest. But then he dies, right? Samuel dies. And his sons, well, they're almost as bad as Hophni and Phinehas, right? They turn out bad as well. So put your hope in Samuel. Well, your hope won't last very long. It turns out that Hophni and Phinehas point to Samuel, and Samuel points somewhere else, and Luke wants us to notice this. Because when Luke tells the story of the childhood of Jesus, what does he do? Well, first of all, he makes clear that when Mary becomes pregnant and it's announced to her that she is pregnant with the Messiah, she sings this song, right? And you know where that song comes from? It directly echoes Hannah's song in 1 Samuel. And then when Luke tells us about Jesus, this incident in his childhood when he goes into Jerusalem and he stays in the temple and gets left behind, this kind of odd random story of his childhood, how does Luke end that story? He ends that story by saying, and Jesus grew in wisdom and stature and favor with God and men, and that is a direct quote from 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 26, where Samuel grew in stature and in favor with God and men. And Luke wants to say, here's your Samuel. Here's the one you're waiting for. Here's the one who is your priest, who will really meet your need for a priest who is righteous. So what difference does this make for Monday morning, right? What difference on earth does this make for Monday morning? Here's the difference. Well, first of all, actually, you know, it should actually make you a little bit gracious towards fallen priests, fallen pastors, and fallen missionaries, because they are serving a purpose. You know what purpose they're serving? They are meant to remind you that your hope was never supposed to be in them to begin with. Right? They were just filling this role that God had for them, and they point to something else. Hophni and Phinehas point to Samuel. Samuel points to Jesus. The fallen priest, whether of ancient times or of modern times, is just a reminder that they're just a human being and that their role was to point to something different, something greater. So that's the first thing it might do. But what else might it do? I think we can look to Hebrews chapter 10. Hebrews chapter 10, there's a wonderful passage, verses 19 to 22. And in that passage, we read that since we have this great high priest, that is Jesus. Well, since we have this great high priest, let us draw near. Let us draw near to God. So I think that's where it takes us on Monday morning. We have no excuse at any moment in our lives not to draw near to God because we have a great high priest. We have the priest who stands in the great tabernacle of heaven and intercedes before us for God. So when we're out on that hike later today, draw near to God. When you're facing some difficulty at home or at work tomorrow morning, draw near to God. Right? At every moment, draw near to God. There is no excuse not to draw near to God because he's given us this invitation and he is the great high priest and there is no other. And why can he do it? How is it that we can draw near to God in this way? Hymn number 210. Jesus paid it all. All to him I owe. Sin had left a crimson stain. He washed it white as snow. Please turn there and let's sing it together. Hymn number 210.